Blog Talk Radio. Um, Yeah. So the it's a plan that even former House Speaker Newt Gingrich deemed too radical. Apparently reminded by some savvy operative that he might not want to anger the Kochs, to whom Ryan, 42, is something of a youthful ward, having been the beneficiary of years of support from the Koch-founded Americans for Prosperity. In case anyone would miss the point that Ryan is a very kooky guy, Romney is doing his big reveal of Ryan this morning aboard the USS Wisconsin, a decommissioned ship docked in the all-important swing state of Virginia. However, important Virginia is to the electoral math. Wisconsin is a symbolic icon for the Tea Party. It is not only Ryan's home state, it is the poster state of right-wing triumph, the place where Governor Scott Walker successfully fended off a recall attempt by progressives in response to a bill he rammed through the state legislature later. But all of that one second, folks, I'm trying to go to the next page here, but it doesn't appear to want to do that. Collective bargaining of the state's public employees, but of the credit for Wisconsin's right turn goes to Americans for Prosperity, which boasts a particularly aggressive Wisconsin chapter, which began building a network of activists there in 2005. Ryan's association with the group goes back almost that far. In 2008, he was Wisconsin AFP chapter's Defending the American Dream Award, handed to him by a young county executive who served as MC for those festivities, a guy named Scott Walker, who is now governor, of course. Since then, he has made countless appearances on the group's behalf at anti-health care reform rallies on Capitol Hill, on conference town halls across the country, and at Americans for Prosperity and Americans for Prosperity Foundation events. Just enter Ryan's name into the search engine for the Americans for Prosperity website, and you'll come up with the 8 pages of citations. In fact, Ryan was due to speak at last week's conference sponsored by the AFP Foundation in Washington, D.C., forcing increasing speculation about his running mate's prospects when he failed to show. For Romney, the pluses in picking Ryan are these. The Tea Partiers, who are less than wild about mittens, really love them some Paul Ryan. Okay, as does David Koch, who will be seated as Romney's delegate at the Republican National Convention in Tampa. Koch and his brother Charles are major donors not only to political candidates but to In the Most Citizens United world. Those donations add up to millions in political advertisements by all manner of nonprofit groups. Already, Americans for Prosperity have made a $27 million airtime buy for running anti-Obama ads. Romney already owes some of his success in the primary season to Koch's favorite politician, Wisconsin. Remember Rick Santorum? Right-wing base types, Christian evangelicals, and Tea Partiers just loved him. He was giving Romney a whole lot of during the primaries, first stealing Romney's reported win in Iowa caucuses back from the Mitster in a recount, and nearly besting Romney in Michigan, where Romney grew up. In the weeks leading up to Wisconsin primary, Santorum was running double digits ahead of Romney. But then, and so did the Koch-bought U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. When Ryan began campaigning with Romney in the final days of the campaign, the crowds of Romney events seemed to swell. While conventional wisdom holds that endorsements don't amount to a hill of beans, conventional wisdom had an epic fail on Wisconsin's primary night, when 60% of those responding in exit polls said that Romney's endorsers influenced their vote. Romney also won Hang on one second here. Hopefully I can go to the next page. Won endorsements of a number of Americans for prosperity-backed legislatures. But Romney Ryan's pick is not without its minuses, the largest one being running with a guy who has promised to end Medicare and replace it with something else entirely that could wind up costing seniors big time. And don't be fooled by the fact that Ryan calls his voucher health care system for seniors Medicare. That's just a trick, like an employer who promises you dental coverage that amounts to a coupon for a discount on a visit to your favorite dentist. Of course, photos of the children who would lose health care under the Ryan plan would probably not play well for Romney either. And Democracy Corps, the polling outfit run by Stan Greenberg and James Carvel, found Ryan behind to be a drag on Romney's prospects for moving swing voters into the column. Greenberg refers to the Key Obama coalition of unmarried women, group youth, and minority voters as the rising American electorate. And from their latest, issued in July, the Ryan budget impact on the most vulnerable is powerful among key swing voters, including unmarried women, who shifted a net 10 points toward Obama. The rising American electorate net 3-point shift, and the independents net 9-point shift, and even conservatives were swayed, shifting a net 13 points toward Obama. And among those who heard and even split of facts about the Ryan budget, including ones about cuts to programs aimed to help mostly lower and working class families, the shift is even more pronounced. With this group of voters, Obama leads Romney by 9 points, 52-43. And the largest margin of any of the groups in our experiment. It's clear that focusing on the Ryan budget does to the most vulnerable Americans pay dividends for Obama. Looks like the Koch brothers are going to have to throw a whole lot of money at this thing to make it work for them, but we know they've got plenty of that. And I have serious problems with this guy Ryan, and serious problems with Romney, and we're just I don't know, it's just a farce beyond farces, you know. Here's something else that really took my buns today. U.S. drops investigations of Goldman Sachs. The United States Justice Department announced Thursday evening it was ending a one-year criminal investigation that would not file charges against the giant Wall Street investment bank, Goldman Sachs, or any of its employees. Now, we must remember that Goldman Sachs is a client of none other than the prominent attorney general. Yes, yes, yes. And the holder's firm. In April 2011, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations released a voluminous report on the role of major banks, federal regulators, and credit rating firms in the collapse of the subprime mortgage market and ensuing financial crash of the September 2008. Of the reports, 240 pages of 40% were devoted to a detailed examination of Goldman Sachs' deceptive practices in marketing mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. The report alleged that Goldman bilked clients by selling them mortgage-backed securities without informing them that the bank itself was betting the investment would fail. Yeah. Now, shouldn't these bastards be in jail? I would think so. The Senate report concluded listing federal securities law that the committee believed had likely been violated by Goldman Sachs and other banks. The committee referred its findings to the Justice Department and the federal prosecutors for a criminal investigation of Goldman and its executives. It also called for an investigation into whether Goldman CEO Lloyd Blankenfein had pursued himself in his money testimony before the panel. In releasing the report, the chairman of the committee Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, said the panel's two-year probe had found a financial snake pit rife with greed, conflicts of interest, and wrongdoing. And he recommended that charges be brought and said, in my judgment, Goldman clearly misled their clients and they misled Congress. In its statement released Thursday, the Justice Department said it had conducted an exhaustive interview of the report, but concluded that based on the law and the evidence as they exist at this time, there is not a viable base to bring a criminal prosecution with respect to Goldman Sachs or its employees in regard to the allegations set forth in the report. There is not a shred of credibility in this assertion. In the course of its investigation, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation amassed 56 million pages of memos, documents, prospectuses, and emails. And the section of its report on Goldman Sachs gave chapter and verse, provided dates and names to meticulously document how the bank defrauded its clients by selling them mortgage securities while betting against the same investments without telling them it was doing so. We are pleased that this matter is behind us, a bank spokesman said Thursday. Yeah, I'm sure it did. Okay, also on Thursday, Goldman revealed a regulatory filing that the Securities and Exchange Commission had informed the bank it had ended a separate probe of $1.3 billion subprime mortgages deal stemming from 2006 and had decided to take no action. This was an about-face by the SEC, which had notified the bank last Friday that it planned to pursue a civil action in relation to the Goldman security. So, obviously, you know, Barack Obama needed the money from Goldman, or, you know, Holder, you know, was there's some friggin' deal here, I mean, was made. These two actions are part of the ongoing government cover-up of financial fraud and criminality on a massive scale, both before and after the 2008 crash. They underscore the duplicity behind Barack Obama's announcement last January of the information of a Justice Department task force to investigate banking practices and mortgage industry. The Obama administration, like its Republican predecessor, is at the center of a corrupt nexus between Wall Street and all the branches of government, the presidency, Congress, and the courts. And the financial oligarchy operates with impunity, standing above the law as it manipulates and swindles to capture an even greater share of the social wealth. And every government agency from the White House on down is directly or indirectly on the banker's payroll. 4 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, not a single major bank or top bank executive has been prosecuted, even though their crimes have been amply documented and new bank scandals continue to break out on a weekly basis. Just last month, Neil Barofsky, a former special inspector general for the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Fund, or TARP, gave an interview on the occasion of the publication of his new book on the bank bailout, in which he complained of the failure to hold to account any of the bankers responsible for the financial disaster. It was shocking how much control the big banks had over their own bailout, he said. He went on to accuse Obama's Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, of a cover-up, while President of the New York Federal Reserve of the bank's manipulation of LIBOR, the most important global benchmark interest rate. And Geithner and other regulators should be held accountable, he said. They should be fired across the board, and I hope to see people in handcuffs. Last March, Greg Smith... Sorry. Hang on a second here, folks. Last March, Greg Smith, an executive director of Goldman, announced his resignation in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, in which he denounced the bank's toxic culture of avarice and fraud. It made me ill how callously people talk about ripping their clients off, he wrote. Part of the incestuous relationship, Goldman Sachs was at the center of the scandal that erupted in the late 2009 over the collusion of top federal officials in secretly using public funds as part of the 2008 bailout of American International Group, or AIG, to cover billions of dollars in mortgage securities held by the banks and insured by the bankrupt insurance firm. Then Treasury Secretary and former Goldman CEO Henry Paulson, then New York Federal Reserve President Geithner, and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke funneled $62 billion to the big Wall Street firms, with Goldman getting the biggest share of $12.9 billion. Part of the incestuous relationship between Wall Street and government is the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. Bank regulators build up their resumes for advancement to seven-figure salary posts at financial firms by running interference for the banks. This was exemplified last June when J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon's appearance before the House and Senate banking committees. Dimon was summoned to explain the bank's sudden announcement the previous month of a multi-billion-dollar trading loss, which the bank failed to report in its first quarter financial disclosure. The Wall Street Journal noted in passing, evidently not considering it worth further comment, that sitting directly behind Dimon was J.P. Morgan's general counsel, Stephen Cutler, who had joined the firm after serving as the enforcement chief of the SEC. Yes, folks. In April of 2010, the SEC brought a civil suit against Goldman for fraudulently marketing a subprime-based mortgage collateral debt obligation in 2007 called Abacus. While Goldman sold the security without telling its clients that hedge fund billionaire John Paulson had asked the bank to set up the investment so that he could make a killing by betting the underlying mortgages would go bad and the security would lose money. The bank concealed the fact that Paulson had selected the mortgages and was shorting the CDO. Rather than bring the case to trial, the SEC settled at the bank in July 2010, agreeing to a sweetheart deal in which the bank admitted no wrongdoing and paid a relatively minor fine of $550 million. The SEC has similarly settled cases with Countywide Financial, the subprime giant that was saved from collapse by being sold to Bank America, and major banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citicorp. The Obama administration and federal regulators have avoided public trials of the banks because the ruling class senses they would rapidly expose the criminality of the entire system. It would mean putting the capitalist system itself on trial. And folks, if that doesn't make you sick, I just don't know what does. I don't know. I don't know what does. You bet. That was from Information Clearinghouse, and it was written by Barry Gray. So you might want to go to that. Very good article. just unbelievable what's happening out there, folks. This makes you crazy sick. Makes me crazy, to tell you the truth. I'm gonna touch on something else that drove me nuts today. And I read it. This is from Common Dreams, and corporations sneak synthetic preservatives into organic food. Yeah. Organic watchdog files formal legal complaint with USDA. On August 6th, August 9th. The Cornucopia Institute, a not-for-profit policy research organization based in Wisconsin, filed a formal legal complaint with the United States Department of Agriculture against several infant formula manufacturers that are adding two synthetic preservatives to certified organic infant formula. Yeah. I mean, they're doing this to kids, to infants, for crying out loud. The Organic Food Product Act, passed by Congress in 1990, explicitly bans synthetic preservatives in organic food. And this is a quote: "This is another blatant violation of the federal law governing organics by multi-billion-dollar corporations that apparently think they can get away with anything," says Charlotte Velez, Director of Farm and Food Policy of the Cornucopia Institute. The preservatives are beta-carotene and asorbol palmitate. Palmitate, synthetics that are added to infant formula to prevent the oxidation and rancidity of ingredients such as the controversial patented supplements DHA and RARA. This is not the first time that the pharmaceutical companies and agribusiness that manufacture infant formula have quietly added to organic formula the same synthetic ingredients that they use in their conventional versions without first seeking the legally required approval for use in organics. According to the Cornucopia Institute, there have been more than a dozen unapproved synthetic ingredients that have been added to organic infant formula over the past 5 years. The public interest group has filed numerous legal complaints against the USDA, asking for removal and unapproved synthetic ingredients like the DHA agol oil, algal oil, and ARA fungal oils manufactured by Martek, which was recently acquired by the Dutch conglomerate Royal DSM. While the USDA has admitted publicly that these synthetics were added to organics due to an erroneous interpretation by previous USDA leadership. Yeah, right. The agency, after being pressured by industry, has refused to take enforcement action and pull the suspect products from store shelves. The DSM Martek DHA and ARA oils, labeled on infant formula as C. coni oil and M. alfini oil, have been controversial since the preponderance of scientific published research concluded that they do not benefit infant development. These ingredients, which now appear to require additional synthetics as preservatives, amount to a gimmickry and risky marketing ploy. When formula with Life's DHA first came to the market, the FDA received numerous adverse reactions and reports from parents and healthcare providers who noted serious gastrointestinal symptoms in babies with tolerated formula. Synthetic beta-carotene and sorbitol, according to the International Formula Council, contribute no nutritional value to infant formula, but rather serve to prevent oxidization and rancidity. Organic standards require that a synthetic ingredient cannot qualify for use in organic foods if its primary purpose is a preservative. The International Formula Council, which is now petitioning the USDA to legalize the use of these synthetic materials in organics, never used the word preservatives to describe synthetic beta-carotene and sorbitol polymate. They instead use terms like antioxidant to prevent undesirable oxidization and prevent rancidity in powder formulas containing DHA and ARA. The federal organic standards also require that synthetics be allowed in organic foods only if they are deemed essential. The only reason why these two synthetic preservatives are added to infant formula is to prevent the rancidity of some of the other synthetic ingredients that are not essential and have not been added legally. This is a slippery slope, and we urge the USDA to take appropriate enforcement action and put an end to the practice of first adding the synthetic additives to organic food, including infant formula, then seeking subsequent approval. This article is a little bit, I guess you get the point anyway. More, a buyer's guide to avoid organic foods with DMA and with all of this synthetic crap in it, including foods aimed at children, like Horizon Milk, is available on the Cornucopia Institute website. So I would go to Cornucopia Institute website, name the following brands of organic infant formula in its complaint to USDA: Earth's Best, Similac Organic, Vermont Organics, Bright Beginnings, and Parents' Choice, sold by Walmart. Okay, so stay away from anything sold by Walmart, number one. And stay away from Earth's Best, Similac Organic, all right, or Vermont Organics, Bright Beginnings, and Parent Choices. These things are all contaminated with synthetics, all right. And Similac Organic is produced by Abbott Laboratories, a $30 billion pharmaceutical company. And the other brands are produced by PBM Nutritionals, owned by Perrigo, a $2 billion pharmaceutical company. And the only commercially available baby formula available in U.S. stores that does not contain these synthetic preservatives is Baby Only Organic, manufactured by Nature's One. Baby Only Organic is certified organic by OneCert. All right? So remember, Babies Only Organic, if you're listening to this, is the only true organic formula. Okay? And a comprehensive report replacing mother immediate breast milk in the laboratory is also available on Cornucopia's site. So please go to cornucopia.org. All right? Cornucopia.org. And check this out. Very, very important article, I thought. And, you know, these bastards are contaminating our children. While we're in the on the topic of contaminating children, I thought this was an unusually tough article as well. But I'm going to go to this article here by Alexander Higgins' blog. And it's about it's about a Time magazine article that blows the lid off of Big Pharma's dangerous, unproven, and illegal push of drugs on our kids, which of the witch-wired notes, you should definitely read the whole thing, short, important, and sickening. Okay. Wired Science alerts used to a short, important, and sickening Time magazine article detailing who Big Pharma used a combination of illegal marketing and paying off of our corrupt government officials to push a whole new wave of dangerous and unproven antipsychotic drugs on children. Perhaps the sickest part is, although the drug makers lost the battle, being forced to pay billions of dollars in legal settlements for their activities, it looks like they are winning the war. A new psyche. What's that?
No, I was going to come up and help you, but it doesn't look like. Can I? Yeah. Or do you need help?
Yeah, if you want to put the. Lila just joined me here. A new psyche has been burned into the masses and turning into drugs for treatment of all kinds of behaviors that were once considered a normal part of childhood continues to skyrocket. Wired reports doctors push more hard drugs on kids. Antipsychotics are enormously powerful drugs, and we've very little knowledge about what they might do to the growing brain that anyone would prescribe them for ADHD. Beggars the imagination that the rate should go up recently. Oh, no. Sorry, folks. Hang on a second.
Mm-hmm. whenever you push there, you're going to go to the site of the queue.
No, I understand. I'm working with a iPad here, which is really rather hard to deal with.
When you have big hands.
I don't know. Well, if you want to read this, you can go ahead. It's long. But as antipsychotic prescriptions in children have skyrocketed, based on a study, and since 1993, the rate of antipsychotic drugs prescribing to children increased by a factor of nearly 8, while prescribing to teens quintupled, and in adults nearly doubled, according to a new study. Virtually all of this growth was seen in prescriptions for second generation or so-called atypical antipsychotic medications, which are often dispensed off-label, meaning the drugs are prescribed for conditions that they are not specifically approved by the government to treat. And once a drug is allowed on the market, however, doctors are at liberty to use the drug for other conditions, and antipsychotics were originally approved to treat schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but these disorders are uncommon in adults and even more rare in children. There is much evidence that the vast increases in atypical antipsychotic prescribing in recent decades was fueled by the aggressive marketing tactics of drug companies.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years, every major manufacturer of atypical antipsychotics has been involved in the illegal marketing of drugs. While doctors can prescribe drugs off-label, it is against the law for drug makers to market them for off-label uses. And each ultimately paying hundreds of millions to billions of dollars in fines for their sales and marketing tactics, the settlements with the U.S. government were among the largest in history. Hey, you want to read the rest of that?
Sure. Just point it out to me where you are. In June, for example, Johnson & Johnson reportedly agreed to pay up to $2.2 billion for illegally promoting a variety of drugs, primarily the atypical antipsychotic Risperdal. And even that gigantic settlement with the government didn't resolve several other state lawsuits against the company, seeking billions more for related offenses. In 2009, Eli Lilly was similarly made to pay $1.4 billion in fines related mainly to the illegal marketing of an antipsychotic drug, Zyprexa. $650 million of that to settle criminal charges. Further reported last year, the charges against Lilly involving selling Zyprexa to doctors for use in children, despite the fact it was not approved for this age group. Bristol-Myers Squibb paid $515 million in 2007 to settle charges that it is also illegally pushed its antipsychotic Abilify to child psychiatrists. Pfizer paid out $301 million in a similar case related to its drug, Geodon. AstraZeneca paid out $520 million to settle charges over the drug Seroquel. Yeah, in all of these cases, the drugs were sold for unapproved uses in youth. The new study published in the Archives of General Psychiatry found that in 2005 to 2009, nearly two-thirds of the antipsychotic prescriptions for youth were written for ADHD and other disruptive behavior disorders. These conditions accounted for 34% of all antipsychotic prescriptions for teens. Yet there is little data supporting the safety or efficacy of the drugs for these conditions. The drug's effect on the children's brain development is also not known, but their side effect profile is clear. Atypical antipsychotics are known to cause weight gain and diabetes, side effects to which children seem particularly prone. As the actual evidence base that would support such off-label prescriptions of antipsychotics is scant to non-existent, and the evidence of permeating undue influence of pharma on prescribing practices in psychiatry is abundant, one is led to the conclusion that this is another example of irrational prescribing that can be traced to both overt and tacit influence of drug companies on practitioners, says Dr. Bruce Perry, a senior fellow at the Child Trauma Academy. Perry testified for the state of Texas in a case that resulted in a $158 million settlement with Johnson & Johnson in January to resolve claims that it fraudulently marked Respiridol and swindled the state's Medicaid program. One aspect of the case involved misleading claims about the drug's effectiveness for behavior disorders in children. The new archive study examined thousands of marijuana compound treats schizophrenia with few side effects, and they had its clinical trial. So that's something we can read, we can talk about later. The new archive study examined thousands of medical records in the National Ambulatory Medical Care Surveys, comparing antipsychotic prescribing rates from 1993 to 1998 to those in 2005 to 2009, that found that while, on a population level, adults received more prescriptions for antipsychotics from their doctors than to children or teens, the rate of prescription is skyrocketing in younger patients. By 2005 to 2009, the proportion of youth and adults visits to psychiatrists involving antipsychotic prescriptions was roughly equal to 31% and 29% respectively. The author concludes, in light of the known safety concerns and uncertainty over long-term risks and benefits, these trends may signal a need to reevaluate clinical practice patterns. The authors also call for more clinical trials of antipsychotics' effect on conditions that are already being used to treat. The study was funded by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, but some of the authors reported prior funding from industry. And this was written by Maria Sal Avides, and she's a writer at Time.com. So that's kind of interesting, and I'm not surprised.
That was the Time. That was the Times article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got that from Alexander Higgins' blog. And
it's a very disturbing article.
Isn't it that? Yeah, it's really
the thing that scares me is that they have no idea what the long term effects are in the developing brain.
No, they don't care. They just do it, you know. It's like terrible what they do. About 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do a little environmental news here.
What?
Well, this one here. The U.S. drought.
Oh, that's so sad on small farmers.
Yeah,
terrible. And a really small, like, family farm, I don't know whether they can afford insurance for something like this. I don't know whether they're insured. I haven't read anything about that.
No.
Whereas, you know, those big factory farms, they can afford plenty of insurance.
This one's got most of the graphs, those kind of.
Yeah, that's too visual for us since we're a radio show.
Yeah. But I wanted to, there was another one here that, on the drought, that was really quite staggering when you think of how much land is just thrown under. Farmers abandon large fields, larger than Belgium and Luxembourg.
Right.
Just American farmers just abandon.
In square miles?
Yeah.
They can't do anything
with
it.
Yeah.
They can't pay their mortgages, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it says, it's by Bob Pierce, Mail Online. Food prices are expected to surge after the worst drought in the U.S. for half a century.
Mm.
Destroyed 1/6 of the country's expected corn crop over the past month. The hottest July in U.S. history has caused irreparable damage to crops, forcing corn farmers to abandon fields greater in area than Belgium and Luxembourg. And soybeans, which are used for animal feed to make vegetable oil,
and the Midwest will have also been affected, and this harvest likely to be the worst for 5 years. The crisis has prompted the U.S. Department of Agriculture to forecast record-breaking price rises, and some of the world's largest food manufacturers, including Kraft, Tyson, and Nestle, have already indicated that they will pass on the increase to consumers, of course. USDA now expects 10.8 billion bushels of corn to be produced this year, 2.2 billion bushels less than the projection it made last month. USDA chief economist Joseph Glover told the Financial Times they're going to see very high prices. The problem could have far-reaching consequences internationally. In 2007 to 2008, high food costs led to riots in more than 30 countries. But Jose Graziano de Silva, the Director General of Foods of General of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, said the current crisis was not as severe. We do not have the demand pressure from China and India as 5 years ago.
They must be buying from somewhere else.
Yeah, or they're growing their own, I guess. The situation has worsened since the weekend in July 29th, when USDA found that 48% of the nation's corn crop was either poor or very poor. The demand, the department said 47% of the soybean crop was in very poor condition. They were the worst ratings since the drought of 88, which cut production by 20% and cost the economy tens of billions of dollars. The grazing pastures also parched and feed prices at record highs. Many ranchers are sending their animals to slaughter early because it's too costly to keep them until full size. And President Obama administration has opened up protected U.S. land to help farmers and ranchers and has encouraged crop insurance companies to forego charging interest. It also provided emergency low-interest loans to farmers in 31 states. The disaster areas have been declared due to the drought. And there's some staggering pictures here.
Mm-hmm. You can see all cracked land.
Yeah.
The land is
pretty
so dry.
Well, anyway, we look for other amazing things that happen.
Very hard on. Just have to touch it.
Yeah. Well, I've tried that, but it doesn't always work.
Possibility movements of the Illuminati, Freemasons, the British Loyal royal family and the highly funded pro-Israeli lobby or Zionist groups. The pro-Israeli lobby in Britain has been statistically proven to be more powerful and influential than its influential branch in the U.S. The U.S. holds 13 pro-Zionist senators in its Senate and another 30 in the House of Representatives. So in Britain, the Jewish community is 20 times smaller, but there are 18 in the House of Commons and 41 in the House of Lords. In an online article by Eric L. Andrews, the difference between the majority of practicing Jews and the Zionist movement is explained. Practitioners of the Jewish faith are said to have been scattered all over the globe due to their betrayal of Yahweh God. They were traditionally ordered by Jewish law to adapt peacefully in their host countries and respect their local governments. Differing from the practitioners of Judaism, the Zionist movement formed in the late 19th century. This minority of Jews focused more on nationalism rather than the Jewish faith itself. They planned to occupy a land in order to make it home to the followers of Judaism, as they used political, financial, and media support in their favor of domination. The goal of the Zionist movement is very similar to that of the New World Order conspiracy known as the Illuminati, that some believe is behind many of the activities related to the current 2012 London Olympics. It is said that a small but very powerful Zionist group has a place in the Illuminati inner circle powers. Their aim is to create a single government that could control all aspects of the global population. According to Eich and Springmeister, thinkers of conspiracy, the secret powerful Zionist investors already dictate world economic and food policies, controlling presidents and prime ministers, and manipulate young generations of people through music, movies, and sport entertainment. Conspiracy researchers believe that the pro-Israeli lobbies and the Illuminati powers take a liking to clues and symbols. The 2012 logo for the London Olympics has been recognized in jumbled letters to spell the word Zion, the Zionist religious name for New Jerusalem. A possible element of Zionist or Illuminati influences can be seen in the physical appearances of the London Olympics mascots, Wenlock and Mandeville, both designed with one large eye that parents in London find strange and creepy, as the creatures are supposed to be role model characters for their children. Coincidental to the whole event in London, another symbol that has also been recognized in the London Olympic Stadium's lights. The stadium's lights happen to be in the shape and form of pyramids that is visible and illuminated to millions of viewers. The unusual similarity to the Illuminati pyramid of the all-seeing eye has begun to raise questions, especially with internet users who have viewed documentaries regarding Zionism and Illuminati possibilities. The conspiracy thinkers believe that the 2012 Olympics is the Zionist lobby's latest target to invest and multiply on its power in the West. The Zionist movement also appears to have been making its way into British policing affairs. The privatized company that describes itself as the world's leading international security solutions group, G4S, was assigned to be the primary security force during London's Olympic event. Apart from its embarrassment on failing to provide enough security guards for the London Olympics, G4S is also known as a notorious supporter of Zionism and human rights abuses. On June 10th, Moscow's news channel Russia Today reported G4S's activities in Jewish settlements that raised questions in Westminster. G4S is known to be providing equipment to the Israeli regime's military checkpoints in the occupied West Bank. It also sends security systems of technology to a detention center in Ramallah, where Palestinian political prisoners and children, including women and children, are imprisoned and tortured. This facility was strongly criticized for human rights abuses in 2010. Even though G4S has a questionable reputation, it is still authorized without hesitation to be the main security company to watch London's Olympics. Tony Gosling, an investigative journalist, said that G4S is the worst sort of company in the world to be picked for such a position. He also commented on G4S's influence in Britain's policing and control over London's police stations, adding, "This is basically the privatization of the British police force. It's being sucked in by G4S." He added that the company is even starting to operate police stations. They are also starting to do a lot of civilian support work for the police. With pro-Israeli contributors in the vast UK investments, positions in British Parliament and London policing, the 2012 Olympic Games may be an organized hijacking of peace and equity. Interesting.
I thought so.
Those are creepy.
I'd be creepy.
These
mascots are
supposed to be children's things with one eye. That's horrible.
The
all-seeing eye. That's horrible. They're not attractive or engaging. They're just horrible things.
No, they're not. And let's see.
We have about 4 minutes.
Yeah. Hang on a second. Financial Holocaust bankster fraud has driven 100 million people into poverty, killing many.
Oh my God.
August 11th, Information Clearinghouse. Fraud caused the Great Depression and the current financial crisis, and the economy will never recover until fraud is prosecuted. Fraud is the business model adopted by the giant banks. I remember I just read an article earlier that they refused to prosecute Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
And the Obama administration has made an official policy not to prosecute fraud. Indeed, the watchdogs in D.C. are so corrupt that they are as easily bribed as the policemen in a third world banana republic.
Mm-hmm.
The mouthpieces of Wall Street in D.C. pretend that financial fraud like LIBOR is a victimless crime. But the World Bank notes that the financial crisis, you know, the one caused by financial fraud, has driven between 64 and 100 million people into destitution.
Wow.
Some estimate the figure to be much higher. For example, one 2009 study estimated that 140 million people would be driven into poverty in Asia alone. And this is not just a matter of having less money for entertainment or luxury goods. Increased poverty leads to early deaths. As the Los Angeles Times noted, poverty appears to be Trump smoking obesity and poverty appears to Trump smoking obesity and education as a health burden, potentially causing a loss of 8.2 years of perfect health. This is not an abstract concept. A lot of kids will die due to Wall Street fraud. The global financial crisis sweeping through Wall Street and the European banking sector will touch the lives of the world's most vulnerable, pushing millions into deeper poverty and leading to the deaths of thousands of children, according to a new United Nations study. And the report highlighted the prospect of an increase of between 200 and 400,000 in infant mortality, and that the child malnutrition already rising will be one of the main drivers of higher child death rates. And while developing countries will be hit hardest, increased poverty and hunger are hitting the U.S., Britain, and other first world countries as well.
Mm.
And Paul Moore, the former head of the risks at HBOS, says, "The final financial crisis has resulted in the greatest humanitarian crisis since World War II. And we are witnessing a financial holocaust brought on by banksters with millions of deaths in the offing."
Well, we're right at the end of our show. It's 8:59, 9 o'clock right now.
So there you go, folks.
So we want to thank you.
Kill all the bankers. I'm telling you, kill the bankers.
We want to thank you for being with us tonight, and stay tuned tomorrow night for our Wednesday night show, and I hope everybody has a nice evening.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.